Proverbs chapter 1. What I'll do tonight is look at chapters 1 to 9. Last week we had an introduction to the book, and also I looked at a whole lot of miscellaneous Proverbs of Solomon through chapters 10 to 22. I deliberately left chapters 1 to 9 out because the whole of that section, chapters 1 to 9, hangs together as one piece, and it's quite different from what went last week and from what I'm going to talk about next week. This is a unit where the wise man gives instruction to one of his pupils. It really can be summarized in words like this: "My son, be attentive to my words, incline your ear to my sayings. Let them not escape from your sight, keep them within your heart, for they are life to him who finds them, and healing to all his flesh. The beginning of wisdom is this: get wisdom. And whatever you get insight. Prize her highly. She will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. And she will place on your head a fair garland." Those were just a few verses out of chapter 4, but they really summarize the full content of these 9 chapters. Now I want to start in chapter 1, where we pick up the note that I just concluded on in reading those few verses to you, where wisdom is personified as a woman, and it speaks frequently of her and she, and what great things she does for you. Wisdom is pictured as a woman, and some of the imagery is very close to what you get in the Pilgrim's Progress, where we have the Christian appearing as the man Christian, and you have Faithful, and then you have Vanity Fair, and you have Mr. Worldly Wise and Mr. Pliable. Well, that's the sort of thing that you get in these chapters, where different features are personified as a person who is good or a person who is bad. So here is wisdom, the good woman. That's one way that a writer has of getting his ideas across. That was what John Bunyan did. He got his ideas across by seeing characters as the personification of certain ideals or certain bad characteristics of people. Now that's what the writer here is doing. He says in verse 20, "Wisdom cries aloud in the street. In the marketplaces, she raises her voice." You can get the picture of this magnificent woman going around the streets and marketplaces. In verse 21, "From the tops of the walls, she cries out. At the entrance of the city gates, she cries out." Going around the town, at all the main places where she's meeting people. And she is saying to them in verse 22, "How long, O simple ones, will you love being simple? How long will scoffers delight in their scoffing, and fools hate knowledge? Give heed to my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my thoughts to you. I will make my words known to you." And so she goes on, wisdom calling people to listen to her instruction. Notice the three categories there, the simple, the scoffers, and the fools in verse 22. I think we need to define these just before we go any further, because you meet the three terms quite frequently as you move through Proverbs. Firstly, the simple are not those that only have an IQ of 64 or something like that. The simple mean the people who are irresponsible, easily influenced. You know, the sort of person, he'll follow anybody. And he doesn't seem to have ever developed a sense of responsibility. It's well illustrated in these words: the simple believes everything. That's Proverbs 14:15. Person who believes anything, that's the simple person. Easily led, gullible. The second category, the scoffers. Well, you know what the scoffers are. They are the ones who pour scorn on the opinions of everybody else. They're quite confident in their own opinions, of course, and they pour scorn on everybody else's opinions. A wise son hears his father's instruction, but a scoffer does not listen to rebuke. He knows everything, and he listens to nobody. That's Proverbs 13:1. And the third category, fools. Fools are just the ordinary people who are either lazy or careless, and as a result, they're not interested in right thinking or right behavior. As it says in verse 32, the simple are killed by their turning away, but the complacence of fools destroys them. The fools are basically the complacent people, the people that have got no real concern about what is right, what is wrong, about thinking straight or thinking crooked. They just have a very complacent attitude to everything. So there are the three categories: the simple, the irresponsible types, the gullible types, the scoffers who know everything, and the fools who just are totally complacent and really couldn't care less. What's going to happen is that these people are going to proceed through life, and at the end they'll find themselves coming to grief. Then at last they'll wake up. And when they wake up, it's too late. And all the words that they heard, it will seem now that all that wisdom laughs at them. They haven't listened, and now the wisdom that they ignored would appear in retrospect to mock them. That's what we see in chapter 1, verses 24 to 26. Because I have called you and you refuse to listen, have stretched out my hand and no one has heeded, you have ignored all my counsel, you would have none of my reproof, therefore I will also laugh at your calamity and I will mock when panic strikes you. And that indeed is what happens. That's what happens to the person who simply refuses to take notice of the instruction. And then sooner or later, calamity comes, and as he thinks back, it all seems such a mockery. If only I had listened. Well, that sets the pattern now for these nine chapters. If you'll go please to chapter 8, verse 1, we'll be looking at half a dozen slabs of this section. And by the time we finish tonight, I think we should pretty well know most of what is in these nine chapters. Here again you have wisdom personified as a woman. That is, this abstract notion of wisdom is now embodied in a person who is a woman. And once again, in verse 2, chapter 8, verse 2, she is on the heights. On the heights beside the way, in the paths she takes her stand. Beside the gates in front of the town, at the entrance of the portal, she cries aloud. Once again, you have this picture of this woman announcing and inviting people to learn from her. To you, O men, I call, in verse 4, and my cry is to the sons of men, O simple ones, learn prudence. There it is again, the simple ones. O foolish ones, there's the other category. Pay attention. Hear, for I will speak noble things, and from my lips will come what is right. Go down to verse 10. Take my instruction instead of silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than jewels, and all that you may desire cannot compare with her. Wisdom is beyond value. Listen to my instruction, says the wise teacher. Verse 14, I have counsel and sound wisdom. I have insight. I have strength. By me kings reign, and rulers decree what is just. You can't get through life without wisdom. And as we said last week, so much of the instruction in the book of Proverbs is straight down to earth wisdom. It's not particularly concerned with spiritual things such as the lofty truths you study in the book of Ephesians, the mystical ideas of Hebrews or anything like that. It's just ordinary nitty-gritty stuff, the down-to-earth business of living. Of course, the root of Hebrew wisdom is the fear of God, which makes it different from the wisdom of neighboring countries. But the book of Proverbs, as we saw last week, was a very, very feet-on-the-ground sort of book. Kings can't rule without wisdom, but what is the source of wisdom? Well, the teacher is reminding his pupils here that the source of true wisdom is God. There is a thing called worldly wisdom, and of course that leads to ambition and to pride and to scoffing and to all those sorts of things. What he's really talking here about, I suppose you could say, is spiritual wisdom. The wisdom which comes from God and which is based on God's values. Verse 22 tells us that wisdom has its origin in God. The Lord created me at the beginning of his work. This is the woman from the opening verses carrying on in her announcement to the people. Ages ago in verse 23, I was set up before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills I was brought forth. And so it goes on. Wisdom is saying, look, I was here before the world was here. Why? because wisdom comes from God, and God is eternal. Verse 27, when he established the heavens, that is, when God established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, and so it goes on, I was always there. God worked through wisdom. And if you look at the creation around us, you see indeed the wisdom of God displayed. Final part of verse 29, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master workman. By wisdom God worked. And that's why his handiwork is so good, because he did it by wisdom. And so the teacher is saying, take the lesson. You can see the wisdom of God, and that's the sort of wisdom I'm instructing you in. Something that is daily your delight. You go into chapter 9, and you find now that this woman, Wisdom, is inviting people to a great banquet. Now, this is just another picture. There are many pictures in this book, and just as I mentioned about Pilgrim's Progress and Christian and the House Beautiful and Vanity Fair, so here you have it. The woman is Wisdom. Her house is a house of righteousness. It's got 7 pillars at the front of it, and inside she has prepared a magnificent banquet, and she invites people to come in. You get the picture, don't you? This is an invitation to the scoffers, the fools, the ignorant of this world to come and receive the wisdom which God's teachers want to impart. So the lady goes out into the streets once again, and she invites people to come into her house to eat of this great banquet that she has prepared. Chapter 9, verse 1. Wisdom has built her house, and she has set up her 7 pillars. She has slaughtered her beasts, verse 2, and she has mixed her wine, and also set her table. She's prepared the great feast. She then, in verse 3, sent out her maids to call from the highest places in the town. And this is what they said in verse 4. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. To him who is without sense, she says, come, eat of my bread, and drink of the wine that I have mixed. Leave simpleness, and live, and walk in the way of insight. Enjoy this life-giving gift of wisdom that I'm offering you. Get the discernment, the perception that I freely offer you. And if you study wisdom, she says, then you'll achieve this. And then she goes on in the next few verses, we won't read it all, but she goes on to describe again the characteristics of the wise and the characteristics of the fools. She concludes in verse 12 by saying, if you are wise, you are wise for yourself. If you scoff, you alone will bear it. Which means something like this. Each person is responsible himself or herself for whether he is wise or foolish. If you are wise, you are wise for yourself. Nobody else can do this for you. If you are not going to be prepared to go and receive this wisdom, well, that's too bad for you. Nobody can do it for you. Somebody can paint your house for you, but nobody can get wisdom for you. You've got to get it for yourself. If you're going to be wise, you've got to be wise for yourself. Now, I'm giving you the opportunity, says Wisdom. Come in. Here's the house. Here's the feast. You come in now and partake of this feast. Come and learn my wisdom. You can't send anybody else to get it for you. And likewise, if you scoff, well, you bear it yourself too. So we all have a personal responsibility, and nobody else can be answerable on our behalf. Now, that's the wise woman. That's the majestic, noble woman in her house, beautiful house and beautiful banquet. If that is wisdom, what is folly? Well, folly is also compared to a woman. But this woman is not the gracious lady, Wisdom, but the slovenly prostitute, folly. Now, she also has a house, but it's not a magnificent house. It's a bit of a shack with a red light at the front. And the food you get there is not a beautiful banquet, but it's probably something that they stole from the fish and chip shop around the corner, or junk food or some hamburgers, or I don't know what they've got. But this is the contrast you see. One is the thing that's gracious and worthwhile. The other is something slapped up, sloppy, and that's it. Now that is the way that so many people go. And what the teacher is saying here is this: pull yourself together, smarten yourself up, and don't just drift along like any old sloppy, slovenly character around the place. Wisdom is costly, but it's worth going after. So wisdom, the gracious lady, is contrasted with this slovenly woman, this prostitute. She's called in verse 13 a foolish woman, and she's noisy. She is wanton, and she knows no shame. She sits at the door of her house, and she takes her seat on the high places of the town also. That's what the gracious lady Wisdom did. She took her seat in the high places of the town and issued her noble invitation, and this slut does the same. But it's not a noble invitation, it's just the opposite. She also, in verse 15, calls to the passers-by, who are going straight on their way. But what does she call out? She calls out in verse 16, "Whoever is simple, let him turn in here," which is exactly the same as what the wise lady said in verse 4. But when they get in, what do they get? Well, they don't get the nice banquet. And so him who is without sense responds, and she says to him, "Stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant." What she offers is only stolen food, something that's illicit, something that's illegal, something that's wrong, something that's shameful, sloppy, slapdash. And you eat it in secret because you're not game to do it in public. It belongs to the back alleys, this sort of thing. And so you get the careless, the stupid person, whoever is simple, the easily led, the gullible person. He just follows on and he goes into the prostitute's house, and in verse 18 he doesn't realize that the dead are there and all her guests go down to the depths of Sheol. She only leads them to ruin. Now there's the contrast. Wisdom will lead to a life which is healthy, vigorous, something that is honorable and noble. This other attitude, which ignores wisdom, leads only to a life which is careless and worthless, and ultimately will lead a person to ruin. Now that is all figurative, but I think you'll have to admit it's a pretty colourful illustration, and I hope it gets the point across. Now go back to chapter 7, and you find now that we go from the figurative to the literal. He's going to talk a bit more about prostitutes, but this time it's the real thing. It's not just using a picture to contrast one and the other. This is the straight problem of immorality, man's oldest profession, they tell us. It's obvious from the amount that this subject is spoken of in Proverbs that it was a very widespread problem in those days. About half of the total section, chapters 1 to 9, is concerned solely with this evil of prostitution. Not the sort of subject that's usually spoken of in gospel halls, but it's spoken of in the Bible, and I think we ignore it to our peril. I'm not suggesting, of course, that anybody's going to walk out this door and go hopping off to the nearest brothel, but the temptations are there just the same, and the subtleties, we must be aware of them. And I think we'd all have to admit that this whole area of sexual infidelity is pretty rampant. And although the precise details, the King Cross set, although that may not be exactly applicable to us, the principles which underlie it, the basic weakness of the human nature, which is at the root of the problem, I think we should be aware of it, and I think we ought to take notice of what the man in Proverbs is saying. So here in chapter 7, again I've got a few selections, we find that the man is giving instruction. We'll just read this through, and it's so self-explanatory that as long as you use your imagination a little bit, it doesn't need too much elaboration. "My son, keep my words and treasure up my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. Keep my teachings as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you're my sister, and call insight your intimate friend." And here's the reason now: "To preserve you from the loose woman, from the adventuress with her smooth words." And now the writer develops verse 5. This prostitute who's hanging around the streets waiting to pounce on some stupid young fellow that's looking for trouble. Verse 6. "At the window of my house I have looked out through my lattice, and I have seen among the simple, I have perceived among the youths a young man without sense." He's walking along the street near the corner, and he takes the road to her house. It's in the twilight, in the evening, in verse 9. It's the time of night and darkness, and the red light is just coming on. And then in verse 10, a woman meets him. She's decked out as a harlot, as you could well imagine. She's traditionally painted, and she's wily of heart. She's loud-mouthed, in verse 11, wayward, and her feet don't stay at home, because she's always out in the streets looking for customers. Verse 12, now she's in the street, next thing she's in the marketplace. Then she's at the corner, lying in wait. And then she gets this young chap that's wandering around an area he shouldn't have been in the first place. And if your feet take you into an area where you shouldn't be, well, it's hardly surprising if you fall into temptation. I think half our temptations in life are because we haven't taken the trouble to remove the possibility of the temptation in the first place. Not much use praying you'll be delivered from evil if you go and deliberately take your feet into the place where you know evil abounds. Well, that man, here he is, he's only got himself to blame. So in verse 13, she seizes him and kisses him, and with impudent face she says to him, now here's the bit, just get the subtlety of this, I had to offer sacrifices, and today I have paid my vows. She's religious, you see. She's a prostitute, yes, but she starts off very subtly. I was just telling my host today of a character I met in some other place, where the husband and the wife had divorced, mainly because he had got looking at a young girl and she had been flickering her eyes at some other man, and in the end they parted company. They did it all very decently. They prayed about it and they asked God's blessing as they parted company and went off and got hooked up to other people. And both of them continuing in the church, and one of them in quite a responsible position in Christian service, and they got very upset when some of the people said that they didn't approve of what they had done. But they said, we prayed about it, and the Lord had given us peace about it, and what's the big fuss over? The heart of man is deceitful above all things, isn't it? It can justify anything. She's on the same caper. She says, look, I've offered my sacrifices. So she's clean, you see, she's had her sins forgiven and all the rest of it. She's going through the right procedures here. She's paid her vows, a very religious type, been praying and all that. And now I've come out to meet you. Aha, circumstantial guidance. I thought I'd meet somebody because I sort of had this leading. She's got all the language. And the Lord led me to it. The Lord brought us together. So she meets this chap. And she says, I seek you eagerly and I found you. I thought I was going to find you here because I've just been offering sacrifices and paying vows and maybe the Lord revealed this to me, and now I've come out in the street and there you are. Well, how'd you be? So, she said, I've got something for you, verse 16. I've decked my couch with coverings, I've got coloured spreads from Egyptian linen, and I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes and cinnamon. Now come. Let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. My husband's not home. Circumstantial guidance has just worked out perfectly. He's away on a long journey. He took a bag of money with him, so he's going to be away quite a while. And at full moon he will come home. So no chance of being caught. All the circumstances point. If there's one thing we've got to be very, very careful of, it's what people call circumstantial guidance. That is, all the circumstances have led me to do this, and I'm making this decision because all the circumstances point in that direction. I take very little notice of circumstances, and I certainly don't let circumstances push me around, because I think that is fatal. We have got to make judgments, and sometimes it looks as if circumstances are leading us in that way, and it could be leading us into trouble. Now, it may be leading us in the right direction, but we're not just to automatically assume, because we get two coincidences in a row, that it's God's will. And that's the way a lot of people understand God's will. If you get one coincidence today and another coincidence tomorrow, one coincidence plus one coincidence equals God's will. Now that's frightfully dangerous, because it can lead us to deceive ourselves that we're doing God's will, when actually we may be simply giving in to the temptations of the flesh. It's not coincidences that reveal God's will to us. It's the word of God that reveals God's will to us. And the word of God says very clearly, one man for one woman to the exclusion of all others. But she comes out with this religious talk. He's a bit simple. He's a sitting shot for any sort of temptation in this direction. She comes out, she puts across this spiel. All the circumstances point. I thought I'd meet you, I have met you, my husband's away. The whole thing is perfect. And of course you know the end of the story. He is so weak that he just goes into her house. And so in verse 21, with much seductive speech she persuades him. With her smooth talk she compels him, and all at once he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter. Straight into the trap. And so like a stag is caught fast till an arrow pierces its entrails, as a bird rushes into a snare, he does not know that it will cost him his life. One night's pleasure and his whole life is ruined. Go back to chapter 5, verse 11. This is on the same subject. Chapters 5, 6 and 7, complete the whole way through, are all concerned with this evil of prostitution. Or, if you like to widen it out, the area of sexual immorality in general. I think you'll have to admit that that picture the man painted in Proverbs is pretty true to life. It's concerned with only one particular sin. But you could substitute a few other words there and make it apply to a whole lot of sins that we're very easily fouled up with. The wiles of Satan, the weakness of the human nature. So easy. And then it's too late, and remorse and sorrow set in. Chapter 5, verse 8. Again, he talks about not going near this woman, not going near the door of her house, and so forth. Verse 11. And at the end of your life you groan when your flesh and your body are consumed. Now there it is again. He has gone off and he's given himself over to a life where there's no control, no discipline, no self-sacrifice, no denying himself things that he wants. And in the end, his flesh and his body are consumed. So it's not only his spiritual life that suffers, even his physical life can suffer. It may refer to sickness or disease. Certainly emotional troubles, they're inevitable if people engage in this sort of behavior. And so you get people that are getting themselves mentally unbalanced because they're making out on the surface that they're pure and holy, and yet as soon as night falls or as soon as they get out of sight of other people, they're behaving in a way which is completely inconsistent with the profession that they're making in the church. And so they get into internal conflicts, and the next minute you know they don't know whether they're this or that. And so you get this emotional upheaval, you get this spiritual depression. All these things are coming because people are giving in, they're not disciplined. And when it's too late, of course, in verse 12, he says, you say, how I hated discipline and my heart despised reproof. If only I had have listened, if only I had have known what discipline was, if only I had have said no to my natural instincts. I did not listen, in verse 13, I did not listen to the voice of my teachers. And he's now disgraced by his own conduct. He's lost his sense of self-respect. He finds that he's sunk in utter despair, simply because he didn't heed the injunction that Paul gives in the New Testament when he says, flee youthful passions. This man didn't do it. They're not only youthful either, they tell me. There's a thing going around at present called midlife crisis. So it looks as if there's never a time when you're free from it. I think the only difference is that it takes on a different emphasis with the different stage in life because of the makeup of the human being as we go through different age phases, through the teens and the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and so on. And different temptations beset people of different ages. But the basic problem of the human nature, which is sinful and has a propensity towards sin, doesn't change. And what we have to do is be on our guard always, because there is never a time when we can say, I've at last arrived and I am no more going to be tempted. I think many of us find that just when we think we've got this area under control, something bobs up over there. And so you try to get that one under control and then something bobs up over there. It's like when you have a balloon or something underwater and it's not fully inflated and you're trying to keep it down and there's a bubble always comes up, and as you try to push down other parts, something else comes up somewhere else because of the air that's forcing itself up around the water. This is what it's like with a Christian life. just when we think we've got one problem under control, we suddenly find we've got to wake up in some other area. We can never relax. Discipline, one of the most essential features of the Christian life. You go across to chapter 6, and there's just a couple more verses there. Verse 23. For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching a light, and the reproofs of discipline are the way of life. I met a chap once that said he didn't need to be disciplined. And he made the astounding comment that he didn't need to be disciplined because he had the Spirit. And whichever way the Spirit prompted him, well then, that was the way he went. And he said that discipline was only a sign that a person wasn't really filled with the Spirit and wasn't really under the control of the Spirit. Needless to say, that very chap ran into some very severe problems, which aren't very much different from what we're talking about here. It's not that we have either the Spirit or discipline. One of the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5 is discipline. It's one of the fruits. If we have the Spirit, it will produce this within us. But it doesn't mean to say that we're all passive, that we just sort of sit back and somehow God does something in us and we don't know about it. We wake up one morning and all of a sudden we're disciplined. When the Spirit works in us, that's one of the fruits that he's working on. And it's not something that happens overnight. It's something that only grows with practice, and I think that is the same of every characteristic of our lives. Here's the person who talks about the commandment as a lamp, the teaching as a light, and the reproofs of discipline are a way of life. And when we respond to those, then we really are directed firmly along the right pathway of life. And part of the reason is in verse 24, to preserve you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adventuress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart. Do not let her capture you with her eyelashes. This fellow's had his eyes open, hasn't he? For a harlot may be hired for a loaf of bread. They are pretty cheap in some places. In Bangkok, you have to pick them off like flies as you walk down the street. There are so many of them, and you can get them in all prices, from a few dollars up to more expensive jobs. But here we have the cheap type. You can buy her for a loaf of bread. An adulteress stalks a man's very life. Question 27. Can a man carry fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Well, once again, we have recorded in the Bible the teaching of one who was greater than Solomon. Those were the teachings of Solomon, and I think that there is much in those teachings that we can learn lessons for ourselves. But when we come to the New Testament, we find that a greater than Solomon is here. And he says much the same thing. He says it very succinctly, and he goes very quickly to the heart of the problem. And listen to what he said. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Well, I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman lustfully, or at a man, depending whichever way you like to look at it, anyone who looks upon a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it away. It is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. What is Jesus saying? Well, he is saying much the same as what Solomon said. He is pointing out the dangers, but he is saying this, cut sin at its source. Whatever thing it is that is producing this sin, eliminate it. I suppose if you took that literally, well, I'm not sure that anybody has taken it literally. I don't see anybody in this audience that appears to me as if they've taken it literally. And as you can see, I haven't taken it literally. But I hope that I've learnt a lesson from it, and I hope that we all learn a lesson from those few verses. That what we've got to do is not wait until it's too late, but we've got to cut the thing at its source. And so if that particular thing is leading me into sin, then the best thing for me to do is to eliminate that thing so that I'm no more subject to that particular temptation. Now, it's inevitable we're going to get some temptations, but there's no sense in putting myself in the place where I'm going to get temptation. And if there is a particular weakness that I'm aware of in my life, why let it go until it entangles me up and then I can't get out of the trap? Cut the thing before it gets that far, he says. eliminate the root cause, go to the source of the matter, and be sensible. That man, if he's wandering around those streets, well, he's only got himself to blame. He's put himself in the place where he's going to be tempted, and inevitably he will not be able to resist. And so what he should have done was what Jesus is saying here. Cut the thing at its source. Go to the root of the problem. And that is what discipline is really about. And if we don't do that, well then sadly it may be that we finish up like that sad man. And I'm not just thinking here of sex, but I'm thinking of any area of our lives, whatever, because some people have temptations far more severely in other areas of their lives. But if we haven't learned how to treat these things roughly and to deal with them ruthlessly, then it could be that we'd finish like that poor man back in the book of Proverbs and shake his head in desperation and frustration and despair at the end of his life and say, oh, why did I hate discipline? Why didn't I listen to the voice of my teachers? Well, so much for chapters 1 to 9 of Proverbs. Quite a section, isn't it? Not the usual thing that you get in church services, but as I say, it's there in the scriptures, and I trust that as we've looked at that tonight, we might be able to find something that is of practical use for us in the down-to-earth business of everyday living.